I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Biden delivered his first State of the Union address last night and condemned Russia's war against Ukraine, declaring Putin miscalculated, thinking he could divide NATO and Americans at home. Biden declared Putin was wrong. On the domestic front, Biden acknowledged that inflation is hurting Americans while touting his job creation record, a return to some normalcy now that COVID numbers are dropping and the infrastructure bill. Biden is dealing with an exhausted, pessimistic, and deeply divided public who mostly give him poor marks for his performance. He touted pieces of his stalled domestic agenda, including child care and elder care, community college, lowered drug costs, and climate change. He talked about rebuilding domestic manufacturing, about guns, police, cancer, burning pits, voting rights, the opioid epidemic, Roe v. Wade, transgender rights, the nomination of the first Black woman to the U.S. Supreme Court and immigration, and ended by saying the State of the Union is strong. Today on Radio Times, we assess Biden's State of the Union, his first year in office, and what lies ahead. We have three guests who have joined us. LaFleur Stevens-Dugan is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Princeton University. She's also the author of the book Race to the Bottom, How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. LaFleur, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Also with us and joining us by Skype is Will Bunch, national political columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi, Marty. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And rounding out our trio of guests, Christopher Nicholas. He's a veteran GOP political consultant with Eagle Consulting Group in Pennsylvania. And Christopher Nicholas, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be back, Marty. I haven't spoken with you since the before times, so it'll be nice to catch up.
I hardly remember those before times because so much has happened. Yes, much to talk about, much to catch up on. And I should say to our listeners that we have some clips we're going to play as well, and we always want to hear from you on Radio Times. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-94. We want to know about your assessment of President Biden. LaFleur, let me begin with you. You are a college professor. You're used to giving people grades for performances. How did the president do last night?
You know, Marty, he came in with a very tough job, right? He had to, I think, have a balanced tone, but also to try to tout his accomplishments. And overall, I would say that he did a pretty good job of that, and I'd give him a grade of about a B plus.
What do you think, Will?
Well, I was an adjunct professor for a couple semesters.
Oh, you were? Okay.
I was a pretty easy grader. But that said, I'd give him more in the B to maybe even B minus territory. I think he hit some of the notes he needed to hit, especially on Ukraine. But there were parts of the speech that I found either underwhelming or I thought, he had a chance to make a much stronger point than he actually made. So I was slightly underwhelmed. So B minus.
Okay, fair enough. And I'll pick up on all the things that you both mentioned. How about for you, Christopher Nicholas? Have you ever taught anywhere?
I have not. So I haven't given out grades. I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn last night. But I do think that you have to look at the speech in a couple different segments. The State of the Union is always a battle between the thematic part and the laundry list part. So I think in the thematic part, especially on Ukraine, I thought the president did a better than average job. When you get into the laundry list stuff, then it kind of fell off the cliff for me.
Well, speaking of the thematic part, I do want to just play one section from the speech near the top of the address last night where he did talk about Ukraine. He started off the State of the Union address, obviously talking about the crisis and also Putin's unprovoked war against Ukraine. And he did warn Russian oligarchs, including those here in the U.S., that we're going to come after you. Let's give it a quick listen.
Tonight, I say to the Russian oligarchs and the corrupt leaders who built billions of dollars off this violent regime, no more. Department of Justice is assembling a dedicated task force to go after the crimes of the Russian oligarchs. We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gains.
I mean, LaFleur, I don't know whether that will happen, but it certainly got a bipartisan applause, maybe even a standing ovation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the few areas of the night that was able to garner bipartisan support. And I think, you know, political science research, for example, shows that there's a way in which there can be that sort of, you know, uniting across the aisle when we have a foreign enemy or a foreign target. Surprisingly, we didn't see as much of that, I think, with, you know, COVID as our sort of common enemy. But perhaps with what's going on and with Putin, this might be a time for more bipartisan unity. I have to say I'm a bit skeptical, but at least last night, you know, there was some semblance of that.
And Will, I saw one of your tweets this morning, and it sounds like you think the president should have made some kind of segue between, I guess, Ukrainians defending their government and what happened on January 6th last year.
Well, yeah, I mean, January 6th wasn't mentioned at all. I mean, it was quite a tone switch between, you know, he didn't give a State of the Union last year, but he did. Like first year presidents do, gave an address to a joint session of Congress last year, and that took place in the shadow of January 6th. And now, 14 months later, you know, no mention of that incident, which was, you know, basically, in my opinion, an attempted coup against the American government. It was a pretty major event in U.S. history. And the broader context here is, you know, much of the Biden agenda and much of the Democratic agenda here at home is about preserving democracy, right? You know, the push for voting rights, which has been made quite unevenly, and he did mention the John Lewis Act and some of the other voting legislation that stalled. The conversations we're having about, you know, what can be taught in the schools, about what books should be on the shelves in libraries. That's our fight for democracy, and I think there was a real opportunity to make a connection because Americans are watching very carefully what's happening in Ukraine right now. And a lot of people are very emotional about it. People are very enthusiastic in their support for the Ukrainian cause because they're seeing people standing up for their freedom and risking everything. You know, a democratic nation, and these people are taking up arms to defend democracy, basically. We don't have to do that, but we do need to do more here at home to shore up our democracy, lest we slide into Vladimir Putin territory. And I wish he had done more to make that connection.
And do you see it that way, Chris? Was that a missed opportunity from your perspective?
Look, that speech went through, what, 200 or 300 different revisions? So at some point, those folks made the decision not to do that. As a political hack, someone who runs campaigns for a living, the most important commodity of a candidate or an office holder's stature is their time. So let's look at the time he spent on the different subjects last night. According to some numbers put together by CNN, Biden spent 25 minutes on the economy, spent 12 minutes on Ukraine, and 7 minutes on COVID. So that's how you judge his priorities, by how much time and words and emphasis he put on all those different subjects. So again, I would say depending on what your key issue is, you either like the fact that he talked about those, or like Will is saying, why didn't he talk about January 6th or this other topic?
Let me play another clip. You mentioned COVID, Chris. Let me play a clip. And it should be said there were a few masks seen in the House chamber last night. There was hugging. There was kissing. I mean, things we haven't seen people do, you know, without being masked for 2 years now. The president did talk about the fight against COVID and the toll that it's had on the American people.
For more than 2 years, COVID has impacted every decision in our lives and the life of this nation. And I know you're tired, frustrated, and exhausted. That doesn't even count the close to a million people who sit at a dining room table or a kitchen table and look at an empty chair because they lost somebody. But I also know this, because of the progress we've made, because of your resilience,
and the tools that we have been provided by this Congress, tonight I can say we're moving forward safely back to a more normal routines.
LaFleur, picking up on that, how much has COVID really colored our politics in the last 2 years?
You know, I would actually reverse that a bit and say that our politics have colored COVID.
Mm.
That's to say that everything that has unfolded with the pandemic has really been through a partisan lens. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate that that's where we are, but we are very politically divided as a nation. And so science isn't really science. In many cases, facts aren't really facts. And so all of that is being filtered through a very partisan lens. And, you know, his response is evaluated, I think, in a very partisan way as well.
In fact, at one point, LaFleur, during the speech, he sort of says, you know, this is a terrible disease. We have to get partisan politics out of that. And I wonder, Christopher Nicholas, does that play with Republicans?
Well, look, I would agree with the professor that, you know, so much of our life now is informed by where we sit on the ideological scale from, you know, far left to centrist to far right. You know, I hate to say we just have to put up with it and deal with it. But when you, you know, have all this fancy talk on public radio, that's fine. And then you go and do a survey of what actually voters believe, and they're just not there. They enjoy the way this is. Our country is so partisan because it reaffirms where they are, whether on the left or the right. I do want to say that that Biden line about looking across the table at an empty chair,
yep,
or someone, that to me was the most poignant non-Ukraine related line in his speech.
And you could hear the kind of the catch in his voice, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there are some reports saying that that was ad-libbed. So if that was, even more kudos to him for pulling that off. So I'll have to wait and see. We get more reporting on that. But as you know, they release a written copy of a speech to everyone beforehand so they can follow along and, except for Chuck Schumer, figure out when they're going to stand up and applaud. So apparently that one line was not in the in the text released to the public, but if I'm wrong on that, please someone correct me.
Well, you know what? We're almost up in a break here, but are you saying, Chris, that, that people just they enjoy the political fight over COVID?
It's a political fight over everything else, so why wouldn't it be a political fight on COVID? I mean, I cannot be the only person here on this interview that has had difficult conversations and arguments with family members about COVID response.
That is Christopher Nicholas. He's a veteran GOP political consultant with Eagle Consulting Group in Pennsylvania. Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, assistant professor of political science at Princeton University. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with our guests about the State of the Union, President Biden's speech to the nation last night. And again, you can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Will, why do you think Biden has such low approval ratings? CNN is something like 40%. Others are closer to the upper 30s. Why either his performance, his persona is not resonating with the American public?
That's a great question. And I think the word persona is part of it. I mean, a couple things. One, as we talk about the pandemic, people are not happy with the way the last couple of years have played out and the changes we've all had in our lives, you know, whether it's being more isolated or whether our economic circumstances have changed or what have you. And obviously people are going to take that out against the president. But I do think his persona, and it was funny because you kind of saw this on display in his his speech last night in that Biden is very much not a Ronald Reagan type person. You know, Ronald Reagan was an actor, right? And he always knew how to hit his marks. And whatever you thought about his policies, and a lot of people did not like his policies, but he did have this confidence about him and this way of assuring the American people. And Biden, who I think, you know, in terms of, you know, his demeanor and his approach, is seemingly very well suited for these times, but he does have, you know, he does have this very halting speaking style. You know, I think he knows that, and you know, he tries to compensate with a very folksy speaking style, like particularly using the word folk.
I was going to say using the word folks every 5 minutes.
Yeah,
yes, I hear that.
He must have said it about 60 times in the speech. You know, if you played one of those State of the Union drinking games, and if your words were folks and look, then you would have been rushed to the hospital for alcohol poisoning. So that's his style. But I think he's paying a price, I think, for not being that kind of Reagan, performer. You know, I think often people judge the presidency on a performance as much as they judge it on the policies, which I think is unfortunate. But I think that too is part of the price. People are just not. You know, that the average middle American voter is seemingly not feeling confident about the country, where we're at right now, or the leadership, and that's what he's paying the price for.
Well, LaFleur, let me go to you, and this is just a small observation on my part, just, you know, seeing him, and he's not a great public speaker. I think we can see that. He doesn't read a teleprompter particularly well. But when you saw him on the floor of the House last night, schmoozing, you know, with both Republicans and Democrats, he looked so different and so much more comfortable.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. He, he's great at that sort of glad-handing, but when it comes to the public speaking, the great communicator, he is not. And I even felt myself sort of pausing or like fingers crossed that he wouldn't have a gaffe. And, you know, he had a few. And I don't think it plays very well with the public. And I think it makes him susceptible to some of these partisan criticisms about, you know, being too old for the job or being out of step or out of touch. It doesn't really help.
Here's an email from Nancy, and Chris, I'll toss this to you. She says Biden didn't mention January 6th because there are too many Republicans in Congress denying it and revising the history. He wasn't out to embarrass them. Same goes for the Republican Putin's supporters. They were there in shame. Did he need to waste time calling them out? Can you speak to Nancy's comment there, Chris?
Well, hi, Nancy. I'm going to disagree with you on the January 6th. I think on that, and this is just pure my opinion, is cooler heads prevailed, and a lot of those people now are coming up for trial, and I think the Biden folks were like, look, we don't want to put our thumb on the scale or be accused of that while people are literally starting to go to trial on January 6th. Let the justice system work. In terms of the Putin part, I agree there's too many people in my party that play footsie with these authoritarian leaders, but I think they probably said, hey, this issue of Ukraine should be something that unites everybody here, so let's stick to the part of that issue where everyone agrees rather than getting into the few parts where there's discord.
Here's an email from Patty, and Will, I'll toss this to you. I had the sense while watching the president last night that he wanted to take the narrative from the far right. Do your guests agree? And if so, do they think he succeeded? And I think Patty might be referring to the section about the police and a number of issues that I guess folks on the far left might not agree with.
No, I agree. I think there was a heavy finger placed on the scale towards bipartisanship last night, and you saw it in a couple ways. You know, I mean, the police thing was pretty striking because, you know, his line that we need to fund the police, that's not new. He said that in other contexts. But what I did find kind of striking was, at least a few months ago, he would balance that by talking about the need for police reform. You know, we're less than 2 years away from a moment when 17 million to maybe even 26 million, according to the estimates, of Americans marched in the streets after George Floyd's murder. And, you know, that seems to have gone down the memory hole, you know, once the George Floyd policing bill, once they couldn't do anything on that in Congress, I think they want to make us forget about that. You know, I thought it was telling that so much of the second half of his speech was devoted to this list of four topics that he went through, you know, the veterans, and when he talked about the burn pits in Iraq and how that might have affected his son's death, when he talked about cancer research, you know, he was basically talking about issues that everybody agrees on.
Right.
And I think he really wanted a lot of the time to be about that. You know, in terms of some important issues on the left or to progressives, you know, including the under 30 voters and some of the non-white voters who basically put him in office in 2020. He either mentioned them really quickly. I mean, he mentioned free community college, but that's all it was really a mention. You know, there was a mention about the $15 minimum wage, but if you weren't paying close attention, you would have missed it. The one thing that, to me, partly because I focused a lot on this issue myself, but it's kind of stunning that he didn't mention America's $1.7 trillion college debt, which is something that affects millions of voters, you know, young people who have, you know, postponed buying a house or even postponed marriage because of this debt bomb that's hanging over their head. And he had promised as a candidate that he would do something about that. And didn't mention it in the speech. And so he was very much going for bipartisanship. It was definitely a tone shift. I'm not sure if it was the right approach, but that's what he was going for.
And that's columnist Will Bunch, who joins us along with LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, assistant professor at Princeton University, and Christopher Nicholas, a GOP political consultant, talking about last night's State of the Union address. Let me do play, and then, LaFleur, I want to get a response from you. And this is the section of the speech where Biden got applause and cheers when he calls for funding the police.
That's why the American Rescue Plan that you all provided, $350 billion that cities, states, and counties can use to hire more police, invest in more proven strategies. proven strategies like community violence interruption, trusted messengers, breaking the cycle of violence and trauma, and giving young people some hope. We should all agree the answer is not to defund the police.
That's right.
It's to fund the police. Fund them. Fund them.
LaFleur, we heard someone shout out, "That's right."
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I was taken aback by the section of the speech. That was one of the few areas where he was able to get rousing bipartisan support. I was really curious. I never saw when I was watching, you know, if they would have panned to some of the more progressive members of the Democratic caucus, how they reacted. But, you know, this is Biden really returning to the centrist that he has been in, you know, early in his campaigned as. And so in many ways, it's not surprising, right? He didn't mention police reform, as Will mentioned. And, you know, even the sort of neglect of January 6th, again, all of that, I think, is about him trying to stay away from things that are seen as too divisive or that will paint him as too far left. And, you know, I think this is especially with an eye toward the midterms, whether true or not. I think there is a perception among some in the Democratic caucus that, you know, running too far left is hurting them. And, you know, with, you know, suburban voters or soccer moms or whatever we're calling them these days. And so I think this was a really strategic move to not paint himself as too far left and, you know, as a socialist or things that he's been criticized for previously.
I've always felt, though, LaFleur, that defund the police, when you have to explain, you know, a phrase like that, which always has to get an explanation, that perhaps it's not the right three words to use.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does suffer in some ways from a branding problem, but his idea or his mention of funding the police, I think in some ways is also a little disingenuous in the fact that there hasn't really been, you know, a defunding of the police, or, you know, police budgets aren't suffering. They have militarized equipment. You know, even when crime rates are low, they're still getting, you know, big budgets. And so this notion that, you know, their budgets are at threat, or, you know, that they're going to be fiscally challenged, I think is a little, you know, misplaced. But I think he also felt the need to kind of capitalize on some of the public's ignorance around that and really try to reframe himself as someone who's not, you know, soft on crime or doesn't support the police. And, you know, that's a weakness that Republicans often exploit of the Democrats, at least a perception that they're not sufficiently tough on crime.
Well, let me talk to our Republican, Christopher Nicholas, and let me ask you about Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. She gave the Republican response, and she said a number of things, one being that the Biden administration, the Democrats, have taken us back to the 1970s. We've got Russian aggression, we've got high inflation, and we've got a crime wave. It seems like, and then she talked a lot about parents and parent rights, parent choice, which is an interesting word to use when it comes to schooling and things like that. Is that the message we're going to hear coming from Republicans going forward?
Yes, because it's a winning message, and I do want to disagree with the professor. You know, people understand what defund the police means. It's not a messaging problem. It's a policy problem. Everybody understands what defend the police, what defund the police means. And for Biden, in politics and war, what he said last night was an example of a strategic retreat. They want to try and take that issue off the table because they've had their you-know-whats handed to them in the last year when it comes to that issue. So folks have spoken overwhelmingly in the country. They want their police to be respected and well-funded. And, Professor, I hope you go out on the campaign trail for Democrats and try to explain to people that they misunderstand the issue, because they don't. And they have spoken loudly and clearly on this. And Democrats, they read the same polls I do, and they're like, get us the hell out of Dodge on this issue. Let's go talk about anything else.
LaFleur, do you want to respond to that?
Since sure.
Apparently you're going out on the trail.
Yeah, well, to be clear, I'm not engaging in any partisan lobbying, and I don't, you know, I'm not taking a dog in the fight. But when I say that there's a misunderstanding of the message by the public, my argument here is really that, you know, my understanding of messages of defund the police are about really targeting resources where they're most needed. And I think across the aisle, it's agreed that police have a hard job and that they're often being asked to do tasks that they're not really trained to do, right? So when we talk about defunding the police, you know, putting money towards mental health resources or social workers or things of that nature, people who might be better trained to, you know, help people in crises. And so if that's the case, you know, if we're taking money from police budgets to help address some of the things that police are not equipped to, you know, that's really a repurposing of funds, I think. And I think that's, you know, what proponents of defund the police are arguing for, rather than not respecting police or, you know, just taking money away without kind of putting it to good use or more appropriate uses.
And we could spend the rest of the hour on this. Let me just read a comment from Jim, and Will, I'll give you a chance to respond. Jim says, I listen to the president and the Republican response. I'm so frustrated with this war of words between both sides, and now one is actually, no one actually doing anything to solve problems and help regular Americans. And I think that does get to some of the frustration and the pessimism, at least that Americans are telling pollsters about how they feel and maybe how they feel about government. And I'm thinking about all the bills that are just sitting, you know, sitting in the Senate waiting for I'm not even sure what.
Yeah, I think that's why, getting back to what I said earlier, I mean, I think that's why you saw Biden speak so much about things like cancer or things that, like helping veterans of the Iraq War, because these are things that are popular, that are bipartisan, you know, that people in the audience when in the TV audience, you know, when they hear the president speaking about those things, they can nod along. It's like, yes, we should support our veterans. Yeah. You know, that would be great if the government could help cure cancer. They're not the divisive issues. And I think, I think Biden was trying to appeal to voters like that emailer. And I guess it's unfortunate based on the email the morning after that it didn't seem to make that connection that he was trying to make. Mm-hmm. But I do think the overall tone that Biden was going for is, yes, there are problems that we all agree on as Americans, and you know, the government can do things to help solve them. And I think that was the message he was trying to get. He was trying to steer the conversation away from divisive topics like the police and like January 6th, like you said. So that's where he was going for.
And Will, we're almost having a break here, but he's up against the Republicans, but he's up against two Democratic senators from West Virginia and Arizona who are roadblocks to a lot of this agenda that he has.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I think that also is part of the tone shift that you saw last night, because there were these hopes and these expectations when the Democrats won, this 51-50 control of the Senate back in January of 2021. There was this hope that they could use that to pass a very dynamic, very progressive, you know, LBJ, FDR style agenda. And the thing is, it turned out it wasn't really a 51-50 Senate. It was really a 52 conservative, you know, 48 liberal Senate that just wasn't going to break Biden's way. And so yeah, a lot of the speech was, in a way, trying to acknowledge that.
And that's Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Also with us, Christopher Nicholas, a GOP political consultant with Eagle Consulting Group, and LaFleur Stevens, assistant professor of political science at Princeton University, talking about last night's State of the Union address and the Biden administration. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guests and with you about the State of the Union address last night against a backdrop of war in Europe, a high inflation, a deeply divided and pessimistic American public, and a president with rather low poll ratings. Let me play another clip, and this is Biden touting his American Rescue Plan, what it did for the American people compared to the Trump administration's tax cuts.
Unlike the $2 trillion tax cut passed in the previous administration that benefited the top 1% of Americans, the American Rescue Plan the American Rescue Plan helped working people and left no one behind. Folks, and it worked. It worked. We created jobs, lots of jobs. In fact, our economy created over 6.5 million new jobs just last year. More jobs in 1 year than ever before in the history of the United States of America.
Christopher Nicholas, let me give you a chance to respond to that. And the Trump tax cuts mostly helped people of high income, yes?
Well, look, you can't give a tax cut, Marty, to someone who doesn't pay taxes. So that often gets lost in the wash. And I always chuckle when people tell me the two parties are the same. There's no difference between them. And, of course, you heard the booing and the cheers as he started that, not even getting into what he was going to say about it, but just starting it. So there are stark differences between the parties on that issue. And, you know, it's always been that way. I think it's always going to be that way. And, again, at least in Pennsylvania, I tell my clients, you kind of know 85% of the time where Republicans are going to be, and the same for Democrats. The key here is those 14% of voters who classify themselves as independents. Which way do they lean? and their leanings often tilt the state one way or the other. So Democrats like the campaign on it, on that issue from their version. Republicans like the campaign on it from their angle as well.
But it seems, and I understand what you're saying there, but it seems also the American Rescue Plan at least temporarily reduced child poverty.
It did a lot of things. It also gave us this raging inflation we have. So it's kind of a yin and a yang. For someone who got that child tax credit for however many months they did, that certainly helped, you know, free money from the government. Who doesn't want that? But then on the flip side, with this inflation that we're having, they're now being hurt the most because inflation is often called a tax on the poor because they spend so much more of their income. And so when prices go up at the pump, at the grocery store, et cetera, they get hurt first and most.
And LaFleur, I mean, I know you're not an economist, but I think, I mean, we all were, you know, you can see it, you can feel it. I mean, inflation has such a powerful effect, and especially on people with lower incomes.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you say that because I was going to preface it by saying I'm not an economist. But I will say that, you know, he's trying to point to these bread and butter issues and to show sensitivity to, you know, the average American. And he doesn't have, you know, unfortunately, I think, too many bright spots to point to from, you know, his first year in office. And I think the American Rescue Plan is one of those areas. And, you know, he made that effort to do that sort of a sharp contrast with Trump there. And I think that was one area where he wasn't necessarily trying to go for that sort of more bipartisan tone. And, you know, there's an opportunity with the State of the Union for the president to show what he has done and what he hopes to continue to do. And so I think, you know, he saw that as an opening to, you know, draw that stark contrast, especially with everyone up in arms about the economy.
Let me read a couple of comments and then we'll play one more clip. An email from Patty. There's nothing about partisan political fighting that I enjoy. It increasingly feels like nothing like an exchange of thoughtful people, but increasingly like angry, misinformed battle cries. Comment from Jay. I thought Biden did a really good job. He's a fundamentally decent, intelligent man. Let me play one more clip. And this is President Biden actually making just a passing reference to voting rights legislation. Here it is.
The most fundamental right in America is the right to vote and have it counted. And look, it's under assault. In state after state, new laws have been passed. Not only to suppress the vote, we've been there before, but to subvert the entire election. We can't let this happen. Tonight, I call on the Senate to pass the Freedom to Vote Act, pass the John Lewis Act, Voting Rights Act. And while you're at it, pass the Disclose Act so Americans know who's funding our election.
Well, let me give you a chance to respond. I want to hear from all three of you, but a response to that portion of the speech.
Yeah, I mean, I would have liked to have seen more of that. You know, I've been thinking as I've been listening to this conversation, and not just here, but, you know, so much of our political conversation is about this theoretical battle for the middle, right? And, you know, let's be honest, a lot of time we picture this mythical middle voter is kind of a white suburbanite middle class to upper middle class, right? If the Democrats can just get more of those people on board and whatnot. But the truth is, you know, the reason the Democrats often underperform in these midterm elections is not because of those voters, but it's because young people don't turn out, or it's because certain communities, including communities of color, perhaps don't turn out for midterms in the way that they turn out for presidential elections. To me, the road not taken. I mean, he did mention voting rights. I thought he could have done more and been more impassioned about it. The issues that really motivate some of the voters that might be staying home in these midterms, which are voting rights, climate change. You know, so many under 35 voters list that as their, you know, number one or number two issue. The one we talked about earlier, student debt. There's a political path that tries to excite the voters who are frustrated that these issues aren't being addressed. And that's why it was disappointing, I think, that they weren't addressed by Biden last night, particularly.
Christopher, I mean, picking up on both what Will said, but also what the president said about voting rights. And I'd just be curious what your thoughts are.
Let's have voter ID everywhere in the country so people are clear that people who are able to vote are the ones that are eligible to vote. And if you took a survey of 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans, whatever, and asked them what voting rights meant, you'd get answers all over the scale. So it's one of those nice things to say, hey, I'm in favor of puppy dogs and baseball if it ever comes back, and also voting rights. Sure, the devil is in the details.
But are you saying that there's a wave of fraudulent voters, and that's why, you know, we need voter ID because we can't trust the results?
No, I'm not saying that. I mean, I've long said publicly that the 2020 election, while it had a lot of problems, it was fair. Biden is the legitimate winner. Republicans need to stop trying to relitigate stuff from 2020. But what I am saying is that more and more people are distrustful of the election system. And since nearly three-quarters of them are in favor of voter ID, that would be a fairly simple way to help reinforce to them the perception that the system is fair. Very rarely in American politics do you get an issue where 72% of the people agree on something. So I think that would be an easy fix. A lot of the other agenda, quite frankly, from my viewpoint, is the Democratic Party trying to slough off to the federal government what they've long done as a party and that they're tired of doing. So kudos to them for trying to do it, but we're going to put up a fight.
LaFleur, what are your thoughts, both about voting rights and what our other guests have been saying?
You know, I think Biden missed an opportunity. You referred to it as a passing reference to voting rights, and it was just that, just in passing. You know, he is in, you know, he's in the presidency or in the White House in no small part to young people and people of color. And I really have to agree with Will here that he gave them very little to hang on to in last night's speech. And, you know, the Democratic Party, I think, has a long history of trying to appeal to the middle of the road voter. But when push came to shove, he really needed to depend on and mobilizing, you know, for example, black people in Georgia. And so at this point, I don't know if he did very much to excite a group that is inclined to or less inclined to turn out at the midterms. You know, I thought he would have even done more to tout his Supreme Court nominee, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. But, you know, that, too, was just a passing reference. And if there was something to be said about exciting and mobilizing people, there was very little there, very little on police reform, very little on student loan debt relief, climate change, all of those things that would, I think, get people behind him. And, you know, he kind of moved to the left initially, not initially, but through. During the course of his campaign, he started moving a bit to the left on those issues, or was forced to the left. But last night seemed like a definite strategic turn to get back to the middle. And I don't think that's going to get people mobilized.
And, of course, the midterms kind of hangs over whatever people are saying, whether President of the United States or running for office across the country. Here's an email from Richard, sort of underscoring what both you, LaFleur, and Will have said in his campaign laundry list. Biden mentioned once the Voting Rights Act. This is crucial. And only one mention. Obviously, Richard not happy about that. A tweet from Rini: has any president ever said the State of the Union is not strong? Anything negative or just 100% positive? I'll leave those out there.
Can I just answer that real quick?
Yeah, go ahead, Will.
Yes, Gerald Ford in 1975, probably the only time, but it's a fascinating clip where he says the State of the Union is not good, but it took Watergate to get to that point.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Here's a comment from Max. I don't understand how people thought he did so well. I saw an old, out-of-touch grandfather reading from a teleprompter. Let me pick up on, I know, Will, you don't like Build Back Better, that phrase, and I think it is problematic, and it's stuffed full of projects and programs that I think in some of their component parts would get a lot of support. And I got the feeling the president was trying to pull some of those out, and maybe the Democratic Party, I don't know, will try to push those through rather than this gigantic package. Can you speak to that?
Well, he's got a problem. You know, most of his Democratic Party supports things like expanded child care, like the free community college piece that seems to have completely vanished, and certainly the expanded child tax credit, which I mean, to me, it just boggles the mind that we had a program that was in place for 6 months that cut child poverty in half. You know, what an achievement. I mean, to me, that would almost be the top of the speech. Hey, we cut child poverty in half, but of course, it's already been undone.
Yeah.
And we've already seen child poverty go back to where it was because that program was allowed to expire. But he's not going to get these programs because Joe Manchin won't let him, you know, and he's got to somehow deal with that. And I think what you saw last night was he mentioned a lot of these programs to let people know that he still supports them, but he couldn't go too deep into this because he didn't want to raise expectations because Joe Manchin and to a certain degree Kyrsten Sinema are the roadblocks to getting those programs passed, which is unfortunate because I do think most of these ideas are very popular politically.
And Chris, is Mitch McConnell, is his goal to make Biden a one-term president?
Well, I just want you all to note the time and date because I agree with what Will said.
Oh, my goodness.
So
10:55, 10.
Yeah. Look, every Senate leader of the opposite party of the president wants to make that president a one-term president. It's like the sun coming up every day and the sun going down every day. It's just how things are. So, of course he does. He was just on Fox News earlier today saying that while he has a cordial relationship with the president, he thought he missed the boat, and I'm paraphrasing here, on the speech last night, obviously from perhaps a slightly different perspective than why Will thought he missed the boat. So, yeah, that's Marty, that's how politics works.
Mm. Let me go back to you, LaFleur, and you mentioned Ketanji Brown Jackson. I mean, her announcement got buried by all the news coming from Ukraine, but we're talking about, you know, a really historic Supreme Court nomination, the first black woman, if she is confirmed, that would be sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court. Also, we saw two women sitting behind, the president last night, Nancy Pelosi and Vice President Kamala Harris. And I just want to give you a chance to just remark on that moment and this moment.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say the optics on that are great. And let's see what happens substantively. I think these are the things in terms of sort of the diversity of his cabinet and representation that he's been able to bring back to the cabinet are things that get people excited, even if it's largely symbolic. But I think he needs to do a bit more of that or a bit more highlighting of that to get people excited at these midterms. And I do think much of that was lacking. But, you know, the visuals were great, seeing Vice President Harris and Speaker of the House Pelosi. You know, I have a young daughter, and she was excited.
Well, and I was thinking to myself, I don't think she's going to tear up Biden's speech. That would be, of course, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Well, we have to leave it there. LaFleur, Stephen Stugan, thank you, as always, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Assistant Professor of Political Science at Princeton University, author of Race to the Bottom, How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. Will Bunch, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. National opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Christopher Nichols, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Always a fun time with you, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. GOP political consultant with Eagle Consulting Group, which is here in Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to look for more of our programs. And we've got thousands of them archived there. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.